Good day, everyone. My name is Mike Curlew. I am here in Sioux Lookout, Ontario, and today we're going to be traveling down to London Health Sciences Center. We're going to be speaking today with Dr. Heidi Hensel. Dr. Hensel is a pediatric psychiatrist at Children's Hospital and London Health Sciences Center, and we're going to be talking as well to Dr. Jacqueline Ogilvie, who's a developmental pediatrician at Children's Hospital, London's Health Sciences Center. Now, you know what? Mental health awareness and understanding has been highlighted in the media with many campaigns like Bell, Let's Talk, but oftentimes the mental health of our youngest children can easily get forgotten and overlooked. Building good mental health starts early, and parents, caregivers, and healthcare providers can play a key role in establishing good mental health. So, you know what, when I first heard about infant mental health, it kind of blew my mind, to be honest with you. So for our guests, what do we mean by infant mental health?
Yeah, I can understand how you felt that way, Mike. It's kind of a difficult thing to wrap your head around. I think when I tell people that I have an interest in infant mental health and work in infant mental health, they think maybe, you know, I have babies in my office on couches and I'm talking to them. And, you know, I have to clarify that, you know, I don't speak goo goo gaga.
You don't speak goo goo gaga?
Oh my. And I also am very careful about putting babies on couches because, of course, they can always roll off.
Oh my God. What would the CPS say, right?
Exactly. So that's not really what it's about. And it's not about diagnosing a baby with a mental illness because, you know, babies, you know, they're living their own crazy lives as babies, but there's really not much that you see in terms of mental illness. It's really about preventing the development of problems in mental health and really promoting good mental health in infants and children.
Mike, it's funny that you should say that because even as a pediatrician going through several years of training, it really wasn't until my fellowship in developmental pediatrics that I got a good handle on this thing called infant mental health. And I have to say, when I looked at one of my training requirements and that I was going to be working with a infant psychiatrist, I thought, boy, what's going on out in Edmonton that they have psychiatrists for babies? But that just isn't the case, and as Dr. Hensel or Heidi alluded to, it really is about prevention. It's about starting early to promote strong relationships between infants and their caregivers and those around them, as those relationships will really form the foundation for children feeling valued, worthwhile, and building a sense of well-being as they grow. And it has a strong link to attachment and trauma-informed care as well.
Yeah, I know. I am so excited today because infant mental health, like my first thought is like, what are they putting in the water in the River Thames, you know? Now, you mentioned attachment-focused approaches. Can you describe kind of what that means?
Absolutely. So attachment theory really has been around for many, many decades. And it really describes that intense relationship that can develop or that hopefully develops between an infant and their caregiver. And we often talk about a primary caregiver. It's a bi-directional relationship, so it's the connectedness that is established between infant and often the parent, but it can be a different caregiver as well. And it really is different from bonding. It's that emotional and psychological connection that develops. So it's more than just about providing a safe house, nutrition, and changing diapers. It's about how responsive that caregiver is to the child's needs. And that the child eventually learns that there's somebody who's there for them, who's going to respond to their needs in a way that makes them feel better, when in those early months, those are things that baby can't do for themselves. They know things might feel uncomfortable or scary, but they don't know how to make it right. So it's often this parent responding to those cues. And of course, as parents, it doesn't come with a handbook. So you don't know what those cues and responses should be. And so you really are learning along the way. But it's following your instincts to figure out how you respond to your infant to build a foundation for a secure attachment. Mm-hmm. And so children can develop secure and insecure attachments. attachments, and most children, fortunately, develop secure attachment. And that's behaviors they show in clinic around responding to their caregiver, looking for that caregiver when they're feeling somewhat anxious or unsure. And as we move on in development, even noticing the difference between that six-month baby visit and the nine-month baby visit.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows who does well baby visits, but at 9 months, that stranger anxiety has kicked in, and those babies are looking towards their parents for that security and that sense of calm.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some clinical signs that you can see, or signs you can look for in clinic to look for that secure attachment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's really looking for that, as you say, that secure attachment or so. Yeah.
Right, and that secure base, we'll talk to more as we go through, but that really is important for an important foundation for the rest of development to go on.
Oh, wow. I wish we were having this conversation a few years ago when I had my kids. You know, I'm sure I feel it would have helped me greatly.
Well, it's good we're having it now. We can spread the word.
I know. Exactly.
Well, the good news is, too, is that you can actually continue to work on attachment relationships with people when they're children and when they're adults. So, I can talk a little bit about what you might be looking for to see whether your own kids have disrupted attachment.
There you go.
which I hope isn't the case. The kids actually who are most at risk for having difficulties with attachment are kids that, first of all, don't have some sort of secure caregiver that they've grown through their life. So those kids who might be in care of child protection services, for example, and have been in multiple homes, particularly in the end of that first year of life, when a selective attachment relationship is when caregiver is really forming. But then the other thing is a parent who, for example, is like neglectful or is abusive, that's going to be something that's going to put a child at risk for having insecure or disrupted attachment. But there's some other things that parents, you know, that aren't so easily recognizable might be doing that can put the attachment relationship at risk. So, for example, if a parent isn't consistently available to the kids, they might be preoccupied with something that's going on. So, for example, taking some time out occasionally to record podcasts wouldn't necessarily put a kid's attachment at risk. But if you were in a situation where you were consistently, attending to your own needs over the child's, or you were preoccupied with your own anxieties and then not really taking cues from the children, from your child, that might be something that would cause the attachment to be disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other thing is sometimes parents feel like they don't want to spoil their child, and they get the idea if they are actually following their baby's cues, they're going to turn their child into like a spoiled brat, for example. And so sometimes that can go overboard, and your child then feels like their needs aren't being attended to.
Mm-hmm.
So what you might see in a child in that circumstance, for example, is they don't really know how to go to people for nurturance, because that's always been something they've been turned away from.
Mm-hmm.
And the other instances where the caregiver can't consistently be available to them to supply the comfort that they need, they become really preoccupied with making sure that the caregiver is around all the time. So then they may become really clingy, for example, or have difficulty with separating from their caregiver. Kids like that, they might have trouble like actually exploring and playing in situations even when the caregiver is present, and they feel like they should feel comfortable and be able to explore. It's really sad if you think about those two different examples. So one, a kid who doesn't know how to go out and look for relationships with people, how is that going to impact them when they start school, when they start
exactly
school? And then a kid, for example, that is always having to pay attention to making sure that their parent is available to them. Again, they're not able to, go out, explore the world. think about other things, learn about other things in the world, because what they're doing is they're thinking about the availability of their caregiver all the time. And so these are things that go on and can affect the kid in their development and their academic achievement and their success in school and even into their adult life in terms of how stable their work life is going to be, how stable their relationships are going to be, what their relationships are going to be like with their own children.
So it's really what parents do in that first little bit. It shapes, you know, that it has the potential to shape that child's character in later life for sure. In a major, major way. No, these are excellent pieces of advice, guys. You know, this is absolutely fantastic. How about we just continue? So what does, like, good infant mental health look like? Like, what does it look like?
Well, so what you're looking for, if you're seeing a parent and a child together, so sometimes, I might use this example of thinking about, like, a tennis match where you're seeing somebody serve, and then the other person is going to respond to that by returning the ball in some way. So that's what goes on between an infant when there's good mental health going on and they're in a healthy relationship with their parent. Is they're delivering something to their parent, the parent knows how to respond to that and then can deliver it back, and then the baby can then respond to that as well.
I think as a parent, sometimes I've foot faulted before. I think I foot faulted a couple times, you know what I mean, as a parent in that. I love that tennis analogy, but I know within myself I've committed a few foot faults.
Well, one of the things to realize is it doesn't actually have to be perfect every single
time. Thank God.
So just as long as you reach that balance of it being good enough. So it doesn't have to, be like the most elegant Maria Sharapova,
Oh my God! I am so happy you said that.
Yeah, I'm sending it back. You just have to get it over the net.
Excellent, excellent. I sometimes I feel like I throw it over the net and even skip the racket altogether. You know.
And some of that is exactly what you need to do, because if you're working on laying that foundation, you can deal with those balls that go out of balance, and you can get back on track. And so it really is by trying to promote these healthy relationships early on, you can weather those ups and downs as well. Because there isn't perfect parenting by any stretch, but it's trying to be, listen to your instincts and trying to be there and available. Talked about. So really it is, we've talked about how it being that responsive caregiver and not just being about meeting those basic needs for a child. And I think as a developmental pediatrician, I'm also looking for evolution of a child meeting their social-emotional milestones. And so knowing that a child's got the opportunity and that strong foundation of good infant mental health, then they're going to be able to move through those other milestones. And I think human beings are inherently social beings. I do believe that. Mm-hmm. And so given the right situation and the opportunity for those interactions, they're going to be interact with those around them. You're looking for things like at very early on, you're even looking at the newborn stage after a month, that babies are starting to respond to their caregivers. They're not smiling per se, unless sometimes it's a little bit of gas, as we often say. But at that month, you may see when a familiar caregiver comes and is cooing to them or making soft sounds and getting nice and close, because remember the infant's visual acuity is they're really quite nearsighted, and so you have to be within about 12 inches of their face to get to their focal point, which interestingly enough is that distance between when a child's lying in your arms, it's that distance from their face to your face when they're down in the crux of your elbow. And so you'll see that they start to wiggle their legs a little bit more when they have a caregiver who's interacting with them, attending to them, and someone who's familiar to them. And then as they move on to 2 months, you're getting that social smile, that it's not just a smile that you're not sure what it was related to, but it actually is in response to another smile or another person. And then by 6 months, they should be showing those peekaboo interest in social games, things like peekaboo, looking to see if things are hidden. Well, they're showing how they're finding that that's fun, and that if you're making funny faces or noises, try to memorize, well, I guess my residents would probably say it's not so easy to memorize, but you can at least look at that chart of the gross motor milestones and remember your mnemonics for when things happen. But I would really encourage learners to not overlook the social and emotional milestones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think we are learning more and more about how they relate to children growing up into well-adjusted adults.
Exactly. That perfect idea of, you know, achieving those milestones early on or making those investments in child development and social, emotional milestones early on, you know, that really pays dividends later on in life.
Correct.
Perfect. Perfect.
I think the other thing to know, though, is that good infant mental health isn't cookie cutter. So there's a lot of different ways that that can look. So, you know, the serve and return is important. Those social emotional milestones are important, but that doesn't mean that you have to have a perfect, you know, Pampers commercial baby.
Thank God, you reassured me. I am so reassured by that statement.
Yeah. So I mean, as much as the relationship affects things, every baby comes into the world with their own personality, and we actually call that it's called the official word for it is temperament.
Right.
And so those are the things that are like inherent part of the baby. So some babies just come into the world and they're fussier. They don't sleep well. They don't eat well. And that's just part of their personality. And it's about the parents being able to work with that baby and how they can navigate the struggles that temperament might pose for the baby in their development.
No, I definitely have had experience with that. I love this. I'm getting all this amazing parenting advice. It's fantastic. All right. So how would you work with like parents and caregivers to promote, like as how, you know, promote, you know, infant mental health? Exactly.
So it's actually just telling people that this is something that exists, that you have to realize that this is something that starts day one with your baby, and educate them about what are those social and emotional milestones that you would be looking out for, and you know that these are things that can be subtle. But a lot of times what happens when you educate caregivers about it is once they start to notice it, they get more excited about it and they start to, you know, seek to have those types of interactions where those milestones are coming out even more. So again, it goes back to that serve and return and return and return and return.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. Like, I remember when I had my kids, you know, the first few days, like, all that was running through my mind was, like, do not drop child, do not drop child, do not drop child. You know, that was just replaying through my mind, you know what I mean, over and over and over again. You know, but as you think about it, as you watch the child, you know, develop, developing its temperament, that is really an amazing process.
That's
very good. Step one, do not drop child.
That's when the baby
number podcast.
Yeah, well, that's when the baby actually starts to like show some of those reciprocal interactions. And your brain's a little bit more freed up. It's not as preoccupied and you can start to respond to those. And again, the other part to working with parents and caregivers is also just to emphasize how important attachment is. And like dispelling those myths about, oh, you can, you know, if you pick up your baby when your baby cries, that you're going to be spoiling the baby. So that's not true. When you pick up your baby when your baby cries, that's responding to your baby's needs. And how important it is to, you know, play with your baby, how important it is to be snuggling with your baby and have that skin-to-skin contact and how that promotes attachment.
No, all those things are extremely, extremely valuable for sure.
Absolutely. And I think promoting good infant health and our mental health and working with caregivers, for those of us who have the privilege of doing some of those well baby visits and check-ins, you're seeing parents 3 months when they're exhausted, and so really giving them some of those, that space and permission to kind of sit back and enjoy their child, and really notice some of the things that they're doing well. So, you know, when that they come in for their 1 month checkup and the baby starts crying and the parent picks them up and starts to soothe them, just those little things, I think, giving parents reassurance that, wow, I really noticed how your baby calmed when you started bouncing. Is that something you have to do a lot at home? It gives them space to talk about it and to build their confidence, because, like you said, you're in the beginning, those first few days, is like, wow, what are we doing here? And let's just make sure that we get from A to B. So I think in clinic we can do some of those promoting confidence in parents that way. And then, of course, giving them some anticipatory guidance on what's coming next. And the Infant Mental Health Promotion website, which is the Canadian website, has a lot of wonderful resources on social-emotional milestones and games to play with your child at those different stages that will really bring out those skills or really foster those skills in your baby.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're feeling like, oh my gosh, how do I play with a 2-month-old?
Mm-hmm.
Or I've exhausted my repertoire of nursery rhymes today. What else can I do? And so I think they have lots of handouts that you can print off and you can provide to parents, and parents can go and look at those themselves. And I think biased, but it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, I checked out that website and some amazing tips, you know, amazing tips or so, you know. So, like, how does parental mental health impact infant mental health?
Well, we've talked a lot about the formation of the attachment relationship. And so certainly what's going on with the parent's mental health can definitely impact that. So, and the other thing too is I want to distinguish when we're talking about parent mental health, we're talking both about things that are, you know, the things that we all go through that impact our well-being, as well as talking about parents with mental illness and addiction issues. So these are both things that can have an impact. So you have to realize that there's the impact on the attachment relationship, and so a parent with addictions issues, a parent with mental health issues, or a parent with just basically too much life stress going on, be it from, you know, financial issues, not having secure housing,
residency, being on call.
there's a domestic abuse that's happening. So these are all things that can make a caregiver preoccupied with what's going on with them and not able to attend to their infant in the same way and be forming that attachment relationship. So a baby might be disturbing, but they're not returning.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing too is to realize that these forms of stress that can occur in households are things that are going to impact babies too. So, for example, like not having secure housing, not having secure surroundings, not having the nutrition that they need are things that are also going to affect a baby's developing cognitive abilities, impact their developing brains. I think the most important takeaway is just to realize that parent mental health and parent stress and infant mental health and the ongoing social, emotional, cognitive development of infants is intricately connected.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. So we need to, you know, when we're talking about infant mental health, we really need to be focusing on parent mental health and well-being as well.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So one of the things that I do, so as I said at the beginning, I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, but the other thing that I do is I work in perinatal mental health. And what I do is that's my way of promoting infant mental health. So I take care of women in pregnancy and postpartum who are struggling with mental health issues or at risk of struggling with mental health issues because I know that if we keep them mentally healthy or cure their mental illness, that they're going to be able to be giving what they need to their infants, and their infants are going to have better mental health.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot, so that's my one person way of dealing with it, but I think that there's lots of things that we could be looking at in terms of the way that parents can be struggling in the world and how we're giving help. Like when somebody's a single parent, how are we offering them relief? If somebody's struggling financially or don't have any other supports, like how are we looking after them?
Mm-hmm. So addressing sort of socioeconomic factors and those factors' contribution to mental health, making sure that we address those aspects as well too, as well as any underlying potential mental health issues with parents.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing is just like, you know, we need to be looking around, and in particular primary care practitioners need to recognize the signs of mental health difficulties, stress difficulties that are occurring in the people that they are taking care of, but also that might be occurring in themselves too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's very true.
Great. And we know that since we have been talking about the intricate relationship between infant mental health and then their development, so pediatricians who are seeing children and doing those developmental surveillance, it's certainly something that really should be foremost in those assessments is getting a handle on what does the parent's stress load look like. When you're dealing with a multi-stress family, how could that be impacting the child as opposed to just looking at, for example, a behavior problem as solely coming from the child. It's looking at the whole picture as well, because we know this strong relationship between parent mental health and mental illness, as well as how that can impact the quality of the child's development going forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard about, like, toxic stress. Can you describe exactly what that is and why it's important to infant development and mental health, like toxic stress?
Stress is something that there's a lot of talk about in the media. It's important to know that, like, stress is a normal part of life. So if we didn't have stress, there'd be, lots of things that we wouldn't do. Residency, would you actually have studied for your Royal College exams if you weren't stressed about them?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, because there were more fun things you could have done. So, I mean, stress is something that does drive you to do certain things, but when you get too much stress in your life, what it does is it can really negatively impact your brain. So what happens in the body when there's a lot of stress is you get an elevation in cortisol, which is like basically a hormone in your body which is involved in the fight or flight response. So you're kind of always prepared to do that fight or flight. And if you're constantly stressed, what happens is your whole regulation of that hormone in your body gets thrown off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so excess cortisol in the body, it can actually be something that's toxic to the brain. So just like, taking in any other kind of poison into the body, it kills off some cells. And so there's particular parts of the brain that are very sensitive to excess cortisol and excess of other hormones that can be associated with stress. And these parts of the brain are things that are associated with learning. They're associated with, again, social and emotional development. They're associated with memory in particular. And with kids, because at this point in their life, particularly when they're babies, the brain is growing and this is where they're shaping the building blocks of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Toxic stress can have a huge impact. So it's like if you kill off some of those cells, what do they have to build on later on?
Mm-hmm.
So what we know is that babies and children that are exposed to toxic level of stress from things like a number of different negative experiences in childhood, not having adequate caregiving, being subjected to abuse, having a parent who's struggling with mental health issues or drug or alcohol issues, having frequent moods, having exposure to domestic violence, for example. These are things that actually impact what happens from perspective of brain growth, scholastic achievement, also health outcomes. So things like development of heart disease, various autoimmune conditions later in life, and then also the development of mental health issues later in life. So you can have these big stressors that can cause problems like this, but there can also be sort of a number of minor stressors or smaller stressors that might accumulate and cause the same kinds of effects as well.
So it's all about, you know, that cortisol level getting sky high and then affecting development. So it can affect a child's temperament then, right?
Well, it's going to be something that interacts with the child's temperament. So temperament is something that a baby is born with.
Okay.
But and so then it's going to be those characteristics that a baby's born with are going to affect how these different ways that their brain develops actually end up showing themselves in the world. So if you have a very temperamentally intense baby and they don't learn to emotionally regulate, what you get is a kid who's going to be, you know, potentially going out and causing fights and being, you know, excessively aggressive. Versus if you have a kid that has a more regulated temperament, they might be exposed to things and they won't have such a big effect, or you might see them be more inhibited in relationships.
I should have paid more attention. We're talking about cortisol, and I'm having physiology first year medical school flashbacks.
Your own cortisol's
right. My own cortisol level is sky high right now. All right. Well, we've talked about a lot of factors that come from the caregiver. What about the child? Right. Like, are babies like this blank slate that we can sort of shape and mold if we follow all these suggestions, or is there more to the story?
So glad you asked, because there's definitely more to the story, and as Dr. Hensel alluded to a little bit in her last answers, this idea of temperament that really is hardwired, and as we know more about it, that children come into the world with a unique set of characteristics that just seem to be hardwired into their makeup. We see clusters certainly within families or within cultural groups, but it does dictate how they respond to new situations, their level of attention, their level of persistence. So it really comes from the work of Chess and Thomas, where they were able to do a longitudinal study and really able to look at some certain temperament characteristics that showed fair reliability over time and across cultures. And that, a little bit already, it's some of that is the fit between the temperament and the relationship that evolves. And so you can imagine a child who's a little bit more slow to warm up, but some children are inherently a little bit more difficult. They're not as, sleep doesn't come as easily to them.
Oh, I know that. I definitely have that at home. I have one of those, exactly.
That sense that regulated again. We all have little tricks that we do. But babies aren't necessarily born with those little tricks. In the first few months, they're really reliant on the parent to be their co-regulator, we call it. And that's when you're calming your baby, your baby, giving those soft cueing sounds to help. All those cues that you're giving the baby is what's helping calm that nervous system, calm that adrenal cortical axis. And it's then after about 3 months when a baby starts to develop the capacity to do their own regulation. So they start developing ways of self-soothing. Some children take, whether it's a soother, they have some kind of lovey animal that they are drawn to, sucking their thumb as they get a little older. These are all ways that children, and they're healthy ways. Because once children are having, start showing these skills, it's showing that they're taking on this ability to regulate and calm themselves.
No, I'm learning tons. To be honest with you, I'm imagining my own children right now. You know, I have, my youngest daughter is almost 4 years old. And you had mentioned, you know, exploring your world is so important. She loves to explore her world because her world includes daddy's wallet.
Oh, yeah.
And she loves to take out all my money out of my wallet and hide it. I'm going to seek a private consultation with you each to see, you know, if she was born with that, is it myself or mom that's responsible?
I wonder if she's modeling some behavior.
Oh, my.
I think that you should take some pride if you're teaching your kids to save money.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Steal money from daddy's wallet day. Exactly. So when you're talking about like supports and interventions for the caregiver, you know, what does that kind of look like at a bigger level, at a population level or a systemic level?
Well, so number one, education is important. So again, making sure, you know, it's, you know, we're letting our caregivers know about the importance of mental health, but also just the public at large, because these are the people that are going to step in to make the changes, provide the supports around parents and caregivers. And, I mean, it's important to have parents and caregivers and also the public aware of the different initiatives that are around. A lot of cases, these are going to be through public health that are going to be promoting infant mental health and parent mental health. So things like prenatal classes, Smart Start for babies. I think that's pretty universal in terms of being available through the province, through the country. So initiatives where you're looking at good nutrition and education on prenatal care and care for babies and development. Healthy Babies, Healthy Children program. So those are initiatives where we're looking at having partnerships with public health, so that parents are learning about those developmental stages, and they might have a friendly home visitor that comes in and helps them out and teaches them things about parenting and interacting with their kids at different stages. So, you know, really important that these things are promoted, people understand what they are, people understand that they're beneficial.
Yeah, those programs do a wonderful job at that.
For parents, so that when we talk about some of those stressors and those issues that can feed into toxic stress, we can, as a population and as a society, start to chip away at some of those things that add to the stresses for vulnerable populations.
Mm-hmm. So looking at the social determinants of health, yeah.
You got it, absolutely, and how we can, that, you know, it's not, these aren't things that should be just dealt with by quote-unquote social programming, because we know social determinants of health, as the name describes, they relate to health, so they have to fall within our health mandate as well. And thinking outside the box around some future programs, so, you know, having some more flexible work hours for parents that allows them to be home with some of their children, especially in the early years, but as we mentioned, this is something that goes on. Promoting the mental health and well-being of your child is not a job that stops when they turn 3 or 5 or 18. So there's lots to be done, but it's partnering with people and building a voice to make this idea of infant mental health top of the agenda. Locally, with the educating physicians and our trainees who are coming up the pipe, we really—I don't know even right now how much emphasis it gets. The idea of infant mental health gets in the medical school, and given that we all came to it a little bit later, I think we can include more.
No, definitely, I agree. Like, you know, prior to having, you know, just our conversations over the last little bit, I had no idea. So, I definitely agree that's an area that that med schools should definitely make sure there's curriculum on. It's more than just the Denver 2 and looking for meeting a particular milestone, right? So, I definitely think that, you know, it's as far as med school curriculum, it doesn't, you know, I don't remember learning about it at all, to be honest with you.
That should be part of every healthcare professional's curriculum. But then it's also having some skills around those teaching moments when you're interacting with families. So, you know, recognizing with families that they're picking up on their baby's cues and pointing that out, saying, you know, you can really understand when your baby's crying that way, that's when he wants his diaper changed or that's when he wants to be fed. Or pointing out to parents, look, when you did that, look how well your baby settled. That those are things that, you know, go about promoting. They seem like little things, but they're very important for teaching and promoting about infant mental health and attachment relationships.
If I could figure out how to make an infant settle, I'd be a very rich man. I'd package that and write a book on it.
There's lots of things that are out there in the public realm that healthcare professionals can access, that parents can access. So as Dr. Ogilvie had mentioned earlier, for example, there's the Infant Mental Health Promotion website, which is www.imhpromotion.ca. And they actually have interactive learning modules where they talk about core competencies and intervention and prevention strategies in infant mental health. Incredible website.
It is. It was fantastic. I took a look at it a couple nights ago and it was absolutely awesome. I'm like, where were you 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Where were you 10 years ago? Serious. I would have, it was amazing, you know, but I was able to take a good look at it and it's phenomenal.
There's the Best Start Resource Center, which is a national program. The Early On Child and Family Centers. There's also, if you're looking at attachment, a great organization which comes from the U.S. that promote an attachment intervention, which is called Circle of Security. And they have a great website which offers some really great language and graphics for how can you talk to caregivers about attachment, how can you teach caregivers about attachment, how do you teach them about those concepts of becoming a secure base and a safe haven for your child. And then another great website is one that's geared towards newcomer families, and this is one that we've actually developed locally, and it's called the Prenatal Immigrant Program, and so it teaches people how to maybe look at these things and teach about these things in what's going to be a very culturally sensitive way.
I'll put one more plug in for the Canadian Pediatric Society. They have a Caring for Kids website, which is a lot of content geared towards families and parents, and under the Healthy Bodies tab, they have an entire section on emotional wellness, which has a write-up on attachment and what that is, as well as promoting and fostering child self-esteem and your child's mental health. So between the three of those, it covers even a lot of what we have touched on today.
Perfect, perfect. Well, you know what? I want to say thank you very much to Dr. Hensel and Dr. Ogilvie. I learned a lot today. I really did. You know, it's great when you do these things because I actually, next time I'm in London, Ontario, I'm going to actually bring all my kids and ask for a private consultation. Is that okay, guys?
Works for me.
There you go. Exactly. There you go. I'll bring a bottle of wine and stuff like that, and I'll get a private consultation. No, but thank you very, very much. I learned a lot. And, you know, one of the things that I really struck me is that early child development, right? Like, it really shapes adulthood, right? And can really shape outcomes in adulthood. So that's something that I took away from this and some of the techniques that we can do as clinicians to make sure that we are assessing children's mental health. And I even learned about infant mental health, which was phenomenal. So thank you very much to you both. I learned tons. And, you know, I can't wait to go to London Health Sciences Center, a fantastic spot with fantastic people. Thank you so much, guys.